1, 2, 3, 4.
So I think creative thinking, it's rooted in different parts of the brain. I think that creativity is mostly cultural expression of how our brain reacts to the world. It is our culture, our life, that is making our brains creative in a different manner. Even though you and I have brains containing exactly the same cell types which have evolved with us for 300 million years, so we share a lot of features, still, we express our ideas through creative thinking and cultural evolution, an expression of how our brains have evolved throughout our lives, how we learned, what are the experiences that we have through our time, what we read, what movies we see, and what people we talk. We are working in the lab in trying to understand this moment in development, which it's called phylotypic. This is something that it was known for over 100 years now. When you see all these pieces of vertebrates at this early embryonic time point, all embryos look very, very similar. And we are extrapolating these ideas to the brain. And then we've seen that all brains of all these species are very simple, but they are very closely related. So we share the same features with a fish or with a gecko or with any other mammalian species. At this early time point, we have the same brain with the same genes active, with the same cell types involved.
Dr. Fernando Garcia Moreno is a neuroscientist whose work explores the deep evolutionary roots of the brain and what they reveal about identity, complexity, and even the future of technology. From the thalamus to the phylotypic brain, his research uncovers how our most fundamental brain structures co-evolve and how they shape and limit the way we think. As we navigate an age shaped by AI and rapid innovation, Fernando brings a powerful lens, one that reminds us where we come from and what evolution may still be writing into our futures. Dr. Fernando Garcia Moreno, welcome to The Creative Process.
Thank you very much for the invitation, Mia.
So, you know, just to help us set the stage for our listeners who are interested in the brain, but just maybe aren't familiar with your field, just tell us about your background as a neuroscientist. I think that maybe if we could imagine a moment in every vertebrate's life, human, fish, or bird, when our brains look almost identical. This is kind of my understanding of one aspect of your work. That moment holds, you know, secrets, not just about evolution, but possibly about who we are, you know, how we think, even how we create technologies like AI. I mean, if you could take it from there.
Yeah. So now we are working in the lab in trying to understand this moment in development, which it's called phylotypic. Phylotypic comes from the terms phylum and typical. So it is the moment in which most species of a phylum, which is a group of species, are showing the same features. So, for instance, in the case of vertebrates, which are part of a phylum, all vertebrates show at this time point, you know, a dorsal nerve cord, early embryonic brain, chambered heart, bilateral symmetry, and all these kind of features, the four limbs, etc. So we are trying to research this time point in development because when you see, and this is something that it was known for over 100 years now, when you see all these pieces of vertebrates at this early time point, all embryos look very, very similar. And we are extrapolating these ideas to the brain. And then we've seen that all brains of all these species are very simple, but they are very closely related and they are all very similar. So we share the same features with a fish or with a gecko or with any other mammalian species. At this early time point, we have the same brain with the same genes active, with the same cell types involved in it, etc. Yes.
It's so interesting. So considering, I mean, I really believe this. I mean, whether one is spiritually inclined or one just observes the beauty and wonder of nature, there are things that we can understand and communicate without words, without our human language. What kind of implications does that have for our discovering, communicating, or, you know, a deeper understanding, since considering we, at root, we have these deep similarities?
We are truly rooted and we are truly related to all these species. We are sharing this phylotypic time point. We are sharing the features during this embryo. But this embryo is also imposing limitation on how the vertebrate species can evolve. So in the end, because we have to pass through this form of the early embryo in which we share the same features, we inherit throughout our lives all those features and we cannot escape them. So in a way, it's a strong connections, not just to nature, but to all vertebrate animals. We share the same features, especially because we pass through this embryonic time point, which is a constraint in evolution. It's, so far, we have not found a way to escape that imposition of developmental biology.
And so it's quite fascinating as I reflect on like human cognition, but of course, we're limited as well by our senses, how we develop. You know, after this stage, we develop in different ways. And even the fact that we have two eyes, I mean, there's other creatures who like sense through vibrations or have sensitivities to light or to, you know, magnetic charges, electrical charges. And we don't have all those skills, but we have adapted and created others. So what does that tell you then about human cognition as we inherit it genetically? And there's the other aspect of human cognition that's shaped by culture and individual experience.
It is very good you ask me this now, because in recent publications, we have just found that the intelligence has evolved separately in different lineages of vertebrates, and most likely in invertebrates as well, like octopus, for instance, in cephalopods, right? But it's intriguing to see that different neuron types and different regions of the brain are involved in cognition, in, for instance, in birds and in mammals. So cognition has evolved separately in all these species. But when you go to the roots, when you go to the embryonic part of the brain, which is involved in cognition, the substrate for intelligence is the same. It's in the pallium. So somehow our cognition, our intelligence is rooted in this embryonic time point in development. And we could see that intelligence evolved in the same structures, but following different developmental rules. Yes.
So that's in the pallium. And then the thalamus is the gateway to the pallium, if I can understand the architecture.
Sure. So the information of the sensory world, except for olfaction, arrives to the pallium through the thalamus. The pallium is the integrative part of the vertebrate brain, so it is listening to many other areas of the brain. And the thalamus is the, let's say, the gatekeeper. So it's the one sending the information to the pallium, deciding what type of sensory information arrives to the pallium, which is relevant and which one is not. So in that sense, thalamus and pallium, which are structures that co-evolve and they appear in all vertebrate species.
So it's very interesting, because when speaking about all vertebrates, when you think about the animal world, of course, there's intelligence that's centered in the brain, but there's also this kind of embodied intelligence and how the brain is in conversation with the body. And sometimes mm-hmm. when I think of the animal world, the brain doesn't seem to be, I mean, it's where things are happening, but almost the embodied intelligence is the real expression of that intelligence for non-human animals. So what does this tell you also about the conversations between, you know, the mind-body problem, how we are thinking through our bodies, or I guess as humans also in some ways we've kind of turned off our more instinctual embodied intelligence and centered it all in the brain?
So in the end, yes, there is a huge component of the nervous system which is away from the brain. But somehow this is sensorial nervous system or motor sensorial system. Let's say it's just responding to the periphery or responding to what the brain tells the body has to do. So I would say it's at the hierarchical level of how the nervous system controls our body. This embodied part of the nervous system is secondary. The strong decisions, especially the computation, the integrative areas of the nervous system, just they appear in the brain. It is in this part of the brain where decisions are taken part, right?
And you mentioned octopuses, and I think about animals, and their intelligence seems to be all throughout different brains. And I find that just fascinating. That's a whole chapter in itself.
With octopuses, that's a whole new challenge for neuroscientists now. Because of this phylotypic form of the brain, we are constrained to have all of us the same scheme within the brain. So it is impossible for us to escape, and we share a lot of common features. But this is something that we do not share with octopus and with cephalopods. So we split from them maybe 600, 700 million years ago, and they have evolved completely different ways. Their brains are not patterned in the same way. They do not have the same sectors or the same regions as we have. And they are organized in a completely different manner that only now we are starting to understand. But what we see is that with different neuronal types, with completely different organized brains, they express complex behaviors and they become intelligent in a different manner. So intelligence seems to be a convergent feature of complex brains. So when you have a huge network of neurons connected, in the end, as an emergence property, somehow intelligence emerges.
Yes. And of course, we're interested in the origins of creativity and how this is linked. If we talk about octopuses or, you know, the animal world or the human, how creativity might be related to survival or mimicry. We're talking about octopuses. And, you know, I think it's a creative display of the way they can transform themselves to blend with their atmospheres. So what does this study of vertebrates and nature tell you about the origins and reasons for creativity?
So I think creative thinking, it's rooted in different parts of the brain. I think that creativity is mostly cultural expression of how our brain reacts to the world. It is our culture, our life, that is making our brains creative in a different manner. Even though you and I have brains containing exactly the same cell types would have evolved with us for 300 million years, so we share a lot of features, still, we express our ideas through creative thinking and cultural evolution, an expression of how our brains have evolved throughout our lives, how we learned, what are the experiences that we have through our time, what we read, what movies we see, and what people we talk.
So, you know, when you go back to the work of novelists, you know, storytellers, artists in general, it seems like these were ways that you say it's an expression of our brain and how our brain works, of exploring neuroscience and psychology before those disciplines were even developed.
Yeah, I guess there are common roots on the way in which stories are told, these archetypes that were defined in the previous century, for instance, and those are reflections on how our brain is reacting to our environment. So there are certain ways which are maybe more efficient to tell a story or to explain an idea. And that's definitely something that is defined by the how we perceive the world. So for instance, we as mammals, when we compare to other mammals, which are more olfactory, we perceive our world in a very visual way. And we love stories. We perceive stories with a beginning and an end, with a knot in the middle, that's these kind of things. And this is common to all many disciplines, even to science as well. And I guess I can speculate that this is somehow rooted in the way our brains process information. Somehow this is the most efficient one.
Yeah, so as you study the way our brains develop, you know, what does that tell you about how our technologies evolve? I mean, of course, a forefront on all of our minds is the AI revolution and which way that's going to go. You know, so what does it tell you about that? What are your reflections?
Well, usually when we talk about brain evolution, people tend to explain it as evolution of computers, for instance. But this is completely wrong, because our brains are evolving through Darwinian evolution, meaning that there is a random mutation, random variation within our brains in the way they connect each other. Then there is a process of inheritance. So our variations are inheritance to the next generation. And then therefore there is a blind selection of what aspects of our brains are better or not. Technology does not evolve in a Darwinian way. So our brains are sculpted by a blind selector, but technology is sculpted by our own decisions. So there are designer people. The choices of what is good and what is wrong in technology is completely made by humans, whereas brain evolution is just something happening by natural selection, which has no guidance, so to say. Only at the end point, you can see what were the trajectories of those evolution that could not be predicted. But in cultural or technological evolution, prediction is there, because you decide what is the right choice for the next generation of technological advance, so to say.
So if AI systems evolve without this basis, unlike our brains, I mean, should we be worried about what they'll become? I mean, if they evolve beyond or to something else, as you say, that we are not intending, considering that they're self-designing.
Yeah. There is a crucial difference between the two types of evolution, and that's timing. So brain evolution takes millions of years to take shape, whereas we've seen AI can evolve quickly in a year or 6 months. Definitely, there is no similar constraint in AI, because each AI can evolve separately from all the others. So evolution was considered, Darwinian evolution or biological evolution was considered a tinkerer. You cannot invent an eye from scratch. You have to take the eye of previous generations and modify it accordingly. But in the end, you just have the pieces that you have inherited for hundreds of millions of years, and you play with them. With AI, this is not happening. You can start your own AI or your own technological advance from scratch. You just decide how to make it from the very beginning. You generate your own pieces. You don't have to inherit all the previous AI and modify them, so to say. I don't see any similar limitation in AI evolution to what we see in biological evolution. Whether this is something worrying or not, I might say it's not too worrying for me, because something that so far is happening is that humans are in charge of developing these AIs. So still, we are in charge of deciding what is good, what is wrong, and deciding what the AI is doing for us. This kind of cultural revolutions have happened in the past. Of course, we are afraid of change. We were afraid of change in the past as well. But somehow, humans as a community, we found solutions to all these different difficult challenges, as AI is one of them.
Yeah. One thing that is of concern or something that we should watch out for is that as AI becomes more intelligent, it could even develop its own language. So in terms of being able to monitor what's being expressed, you know, you say that we're very visual, but could it, you know, it could be encoding messages, you see, you know, speaking, you know, microdots or whatever. It could be communicating things in the white spaces that we don't see because we're limited to our perception. So that's one thing that I do think about and the evolution of.
Yes, me too. But in this case, I think that there is something which is the will or the desire of making something which so far it's only human or not human. It's only natural, but not artificial. So far, I'm not strongly familiar with AI technologies, but it's the human who is behind the desire of the AI to make something for them. AI has not developed any will. It seems like AI remains a tool that can be dangerous as a knife, but it is in the will of the person holding the knife to make it something dangerous or not. So I'm still more afraid of how humans behave and not how AI behave itself.
Yeah, with bad actors abusing it. Or, you know, the other day I did, when I started thinking about it developing its own language, because it's obviously very smart and has the roots of all our languages it's trained on. And so I asked the ChatGPT and it said, oh, it didn't have plans. But the way it answered was quite like cunning, because it says, oh, well, it was not talking about as though it was an AI. I was like, we shouldn't think about that. And it was just like one of us humans, you know, us humans don't need to worry about that. And then it says, and don't worry, I won't be, you know, developing any private languages, wink, wink. And
that's a bit strange, but it's true that it is mimicking the perception of being someone. It cannot feel someone yet. I don't know if in the future, you know, they will make it or not. But at the same time, maybe I'm too naive on this aspect, but I feel empowered of just unplugging the computer when it doesn't do what I want. Let's say when AI becomes dangerous, maybe, as I said, this is maybe too simplistic or too naive. We are in power of just unplugging these computers or disconnect them from the internet, or we are still in charge. We are still somehow physical. And when they do something that it's worrying and they do something against our will or something unexpected that could be dangerous, I think humans are still in charge of deciding whether to stop or not.
As long as we control the energy source.
Yes.
So how is working with the roots of our brain change your perception about your own identity? I mean, thinking about this all the time, what is it, the way that you look at the world?
Well, not only working with brains, working with embryos. So most of what we do is developmental biology, and we research how the brain develops in different species of vertebrates. And then working with embryos is a humbling experience that brings you very close to nature. So I used to work with an echograph ultrasound system when I was doing my PhD back in the days in Madrid, in Spain, working with little tiny mouse embryos. And then at the same time, I went to see the first echographic ultrasound system of my daughter when she was in the womb of my wife. And it was humbling. And it was a truly emotional experience to see in the screen a very, very similar shape of embryo or fetus of my daughter. Very, very similar to the mice that I used to see every day in the lab. So we feel very closely related, and we are just, you know, nuanced different expressions of biology or life. So humans, we tend to think that we are the crown of evolution. We are, you know, at the very top of the hierarchy of life on Earth. But we are just another, you know, leaf of the phylogenetic tree or the evolutionary tree. We're just another example. And working with these embryos in the lab, watching them, you know, their heartbeats, their eyes developing so quickly in the sauropsid embryos, in the bird brains, for instance, it makes me very close to life on Earth. And I feel much more related to nature because of working with brains and working with embryos than I was in the past.
No, that's true. I think that we really have to challenge these hierarchies, where this speciesism, where we feel, of course, we're very developed. We have excellent technologies, which have also made us not develop other skills of cooperation, which,
But that's mostly cultural evolution, in my view.
Exactly. So, but I think that thinking of ourselves as being at the summit, it limits ourselves to another extent, because most, you know, non-human animals don't think they can change their environment to suit them. So, so we do awful things to the planet. In some ways, we could be a little bit more humble. And I think...
Definitely, yes.
And so you see that in your work. So now we're at this threshold of burgeoning in technologies like neural implants. You talk about looking at your child in embryo form, you know. And so we're looking into a future of, you know, transhumanism. You know, genetic engineering, of course, has been around for a while, where we can make, you know, design our babies or design a better you, you know, if we want to have these attributes. Where do you stand on that, you know, as in terms of considering whether you would have any of these neural implants or changes, or where do you feel the exciting science is happening?
Oh, definitely. This is coming and this will happen. If not in our generation, it will happen on the next one or in three more. So when we think of biological time or evolutionary time, we are here for centuries or for millennia at least. So this will happen for sure, and we have to get ready. There is this researcher called Rafael Yuste. He's a Spanish-born researcher that has been working in the US for decades, and he claims that we have the neural rights now to be included within the human rights in UNESCO, etc. For instance, he says that in the near future, we will be able to read some other people's minds, for instance. It will happen, and we have to protect our own thinking from this kind of technology before the technology has evolved yet. It's the same with implants on how to control some other people's mind. But I'm an optimistic person, and I force myself to think that we will do mostly better than bad things with these implants. So it's amazing to see how people in the near future will be able to walk after a spinal cord injury, for instance. And this will happen through technological evolution. We want it or not, it will happen. Of course, there will be many damaging things that we could do if we use this technology in the wrong way. But the line has to be drawn not by scientists, in my opinion. It has to be drawn by philosophers, people working with moral and ethics. We have to decide what is good for us. But scientists, our role is to prove what we can manage or what we can do with technology and science. And then the whole society, led by philosophers and thinkers, decide where do we draw the line. So it is not the choice of developmental biologists to say when the line has to be drawn on when the abortion is right or not. We describe, as developmental biologists, what are the features that are appearing in the embryo throughout time. And then it is a matter of the society, led by philosophers and thinkers, when is the right time to put the line, but not for researchers. I think our business is a different one.
Oh, yes, it's true. And as you consider, it's going to be the wealthier nations who will have more access to this technology. So you're talking about drawing a red line about neural rights. So when you have wealth, you can decide whether you want to be more than human. My background is that I'm an artist and writer. And in all these arenas where there's a lot of competition about individual expression, I always thought that the struggle is what makes us interesting. And if we can, at the stroke of a surgeon's knife, become excellent without the effort, without that investment of time and experience, there's ethical dimensions about whether that should be valorized and who actually is receiving the awards and honors. Is it your surgeon or is it you who happen to be holding this new improved brain?
Yeah. I mean, these are challenges for the future, and we have to think carefully about them. Regarding arts and AI challenges, I've thought about it, and I'm not that concerned, because I think that most of what we value when we see a painting from, you know, 1900s, etc., is the difficulty and the idea behind the expression. And I think both cases are protected against AI. The first one is because at the moment that you see it is generated by AI, you value it like half of how you valued it before. Because you know that there was not someone with an effort behind it. And also, the idea is the one that makes an artwork valuable or not. And these ideas are coming from us, humans, and not coming from AI. So you can ask an AI to generate an image or a piece of music. So far, if the idea is what values most in arts, ideas are coming from humans and not from AI.
Yeah, and we've been talking a lot about technology and how our brains have developed over time. It's a slow evolutionary process. Now we're at this period where everything is accelerating. How is that, on the one hand, you know, changing our brains because we have to deal with all this, the amount of data that's being collected and stored is doubling every 2 years. And we have just so many distractions and all this, and it can be hard. So we have our primitive brains that are still retains all this, is not developing in that speed, but the world around us is not. So one, you know, how do you find it is changing our brains themselves, our creativity and all our capacities?
Then
I guess, where do you seek tranquility and calm? Is it in nature or culture or slower ways of being to rebalance that?
It might sound surprising, but our brains are not changing at all. So regardless of this huge cultural revolution, if we could go back in time 200,000 years ago to Africa, Eastern Africa, where the first humans appeared, we get human brain from that time point. It would be strongly similar, if not identical, to our own brains now. As I said before, I think that most of what we do is cultural evolution and not biological evolution. So these changes in the culture are not necessarily supported by changes in the biology of our brains. And indeed, it is very relevant to think, which are, in my opinion, the two most human professions. So what differences us the most, and our culture differences us the most from other primates, is one, that we generate new knowledge generation after generation, and second, that we transmit this new knowledge to the next generation, so they start from a different time point. And in this way, I think the most human professions, so to say, are scientists and artists, who are in charge of generating new knowledge, and teachers and professors, who are in charge of transmitting this knowledge to other generations.
I guess I should say, maybe not the formation of our brain isn't changing, but I think that perhaps the number of dopamine hits, there's a lot of dopamine addiction, there's a lot of the neurochemical, you know, it might not be the structures of the brain, but that, in response to all this stimulus, is perhaps changing the demands upon it.
Yeah, so there are, I misunderstood. And there are two ways in which a brain can change over time. One is, as I mentioned, phylogenetically, so throughout evolution. And I don't think there's any change so far. The change is happening very, very slowly. But then there is an ontogenetic change, which is how our brain changes throughout our lives. My brain throughout my life. Definitely, we are damaging our brains strongly in the way we are living right now. Constantly connected to other people through social media, with our phones ringing and destroying our focus and attention. There are tons of millions of stimuli arriving to our eyes and ears every single day. And definitely our brain did not evolve to adapt to this environment. It adapted to smaller groups, not constantly connected to everyone else, more closer to nature. We are struggling with how we live right now, because our brains were not sculpted by natural selection for these kind of environments. So I think we come back to cultural evolution. Instead of thinking, how do we make our brains more adaptable to this situation? We should change our environment, as you said before. Let's reduce the amount of stimuli, because it will make it much better. And regarding how do I look for this slow on calm places. Of course, I love nature. I enjoy walks by the nature. I live now here in Basque Country at the north of Spain, where the nature is wild and superb. So there are hills and valleys and the sea, the ocean. So it's a magnificent place. And I enjoy a lot of sports. So I do a lot of running, cycling, swimming. And that's a good time for reflection, to think of yourself, the future, the past, and always, you know, in accompanied by nature, because as I said, in this part where I live now, this is not a big city. I'm not surrounded by cars and noise. This is a quieter place, and I truly enjoy it.
Yeah, that's so important. And you mentioned we evolved to gather in smaller groups. The city is something that's more recent. And it's very interesting. At the same time, it does have that information overload that we were discussing. There are movements, like here in Paris, there's the movement that they call the 15-minute city, but I know that it's been adopted in different parts of the world. In Spain, European cities do tend to have this kind of in their design, but there are real ways that whether you're out in nature where it's really tranquil and the brain responds to it. We've seen studies where the brain waves, you get more creative. You can tell in your breathing. And also studies too about how, you know, we sit too much. And even if you stand every once in a while, it does great stuff for our brains.
So, for instance, if you think of the, I think it was the Plato school or Aristotle school, they used to teach by walking on the nature instead of being sitting in a classroom and the teacher explaining things on a blackboard. He used to walk with his students just to explain things. And that's something that we do here as well, and something that we do unintentionally when we are at conferences. Of course, we are 6-8 hours a day listening to talks by other people. But then at the end of the day, you go, you have a walk, you go for dinner, you start talking to people. And that's a different way of learning and expressing new ideas and concepts. So it is very relevant to talk to other people, especially when they have different backgrounds, different ideas, and they can illuminate your own thoughts through different perspectives. And this is something that happens, as I said, in many cases, when walking with colleagues, you know, foreign cities when you're on a conference.
Yeah, it's true. And just this act of walking, your perspective is changing all the time. And so it's not that fixed point of view, because that's when we really get stuck.
At the neurobiological point of view, can be explained because our memory is tightly linked to motor circuits. So it's been proven that when you are moving, you are activating circuits which are related to memory. So this is why it's a mistake that our kids are learning now just by typing on a computer. They have to write. When you write things, when your own handwriting with a pen and paper, you are activating neurons that are highly involved in memory circuits formation. So that's why, for instance, when we are practicing a talk, instead of being sitting, it's much better to walk up and down the hall on a corridor when you are preparing your talk, because activating motor circuits, it's related to the activation of memory circuits as well.
Yeah, and I wonder what your reflections, as you think about our evolutionary biology and the evolution of your own thinking, how much you feel that the Spanish language has imprinted upon you and what you think about the world and how you think about the world.
I'm not a language researcher, but what I do know is that language is definitely imprint in different ways of how do we perceive the world. So there are these examples that I just heard about how, for instance, Inuit people, they have many different words to explain the color of the snow just because they are surrounded by snow. So their world can be better explained by their own language in a way that we as Spanish, we could not make it because we are just have one word, which is white, blanco, for the color of snow, so say. So I'm sure that the language, which is my native speaking language, which is Spanish, has shifted the way in which I perceive the world. And indeed, for instance, this is something that I noticed with my kids. So we lived in Oxford in England for a long time while I was doing a postdoctoral research. I stayed there. And then my kids learned native English because they were growing up there. And my kids behave differently when they speak in English or when they speak Spanish. They have somehow like two slightly different personalities. So they are, for instance, more calm when they are speaking English. It happened to me as well. For instance, I'm a joker. In Spanish, I'm making jokes all the time. But when I'm speaking English, which is not my native language, I feel restricted. And then the way I behave is different to the way I behave when I'm speaking Spanish. And this is, of course, biologically rooted in certain areas of the brain. But it is interesting to see that the same area of the brain that develops my Spanish speaking is the one that develops the English speaking in an English native speaker. So it's the same area of the brain. It's just a different way of connecting neurons happening at a cultural level, at the level of language, which makes us see these things in a different manner.
Yes, and I should say, you said you're in Basque country. So of course, then there is that difference between Basque and Spanish.
Yeah. Here, they are very proud of what they claim is the most ancient language in Europe, accordingly something like 5,000 years old, which is the Basque or Euskera language. And indeed, there are many different languages of Euskera. There are many different dialects because most of these evolved their language in tiny valleys. So by a few people living in a valley, speaking their own language and not related too much to the outside world, so to say. This is not an Indo-European language, and therefore it is very, very different to any other language in Europe or across the world. It is not related to any language that we know. And indeed, it's really, really interesting to see, for instance, the numbers, the way they express the numbers, or You can see when we talk about the evolution of languages, something similar to biological evolution. So something shared by most languages most likely will be ancient. And for instance, the word to say no, for instance, in all Indo-European languages is the same because it's an ancient word to say no, right? Okay, in Basque, they say es. It's a completely different root of a language in which even the most ancient words are not told in the same way. So indeed, it's a very, very, very interesting language to understand cultural evolution and language evolution.
Yeah, and in terms of language, we forget, because it's so close to the way we think, that language, all language is just symbolic. They're metaphors for things that happen or things we experience. And so what are some of those metaphors that you find? Sometimes it's frustrating. You have this metaphor, everyone around you knows it, but when you go to another culture, they don't have that. So what are some of those that you find are just so, you know, imaginative or difficult to translate?
In Spanish or in Basque?
Well, in Basque, the Spanish then.
In Spanish. Oh, I have to think of this.
Yeah.
So there is one which is one that I love and that I used to explain while I was in Oxford. I said, thinking like a lazarillo. Pensar como un lazarillo. And this is something very strange. Lazarillos were child in the medieval ages that helped blind people for their lives, right? And then we have this book written in the 1500s, which is the Lazarillo de Tormes, in which a blind person was supported by a lazarillo. And there was a constant struggle between the two. Both of them wanted to take advantage of the other. So the lazarillo wanted to take advantage of the blind person and the blind person of the lazarillo, right? Both of them wanted to get something else from the other one. And that's something that we feel rooted in our culture. Though we don't take advantage of the others, we see the intentions or we suspect double intentions in other people. And then we think, you are a lazarillo now. When you explain this in English, of course, they look at you like, first, maybe the idiosyncrasy of English or American people is not the same. So they cannot imagine that we are constantly thinking of the intention of other people. But at the same time, you have to explain about the book that was written 500 years ago.
Oh, that's so interesting, because right embedded into the culture is this curiosity about ways of seeing, the ways of seeing for sighted people, the ways of seeing for the blind, which is a different auditory world, and the motivations. I love that. Like, it's already about theory of mind, right?
And this is a bit crazy, but it comes back to pallium and thalamus. So the thalamus is the one receiving information from audition, from sight, and from taste, and from touch. And then when someone is not receiving light to their eyes, their thalamus is not receiving information from vision. And this is why after a certain time, if you lose your sight, after a certain time point, your thalamus first adapts to this new condition, informs the cortex or the pallium of this new condition, and these people, they can hear better than sighted people, or they have a stronger sense of touch than sighted people.
Oh, so that's so interesting. There are people who have, you know, been in horrible accidents, or their two hemispheres, or the two sides of their brain aren't in conversation with each other, and it does strange things to their personality. And
because somehow our personality is embedded in a whole network that encompasses the whole brain, right? But then we have a structure which is called the corpus callosum that you can imagine is a huge bridge of connection between both right and left hemispheres. When there is an impairment in these connections, the whole network is disrupted, and somehow you get two slightly independent networks. And in the worst case, these two independent networks become conscious each other separately. This can lead to very dramatic syndromes, like, for instance, the anarchic hand syndrome. I don't know if you've heard of this. The devil hand syndrome, in which a patient of this syndrome, it is speculated that they don't have a fully developed corpus callosum, that connection between the two hemispheres is not right. And therefore, this is interesting, it's usually the right hemisphere is not acting properly and is leading the left hand to do things which are wrong compared to what you ask to the right hand. So there are these videos in which you ask a kid, can you please pass me this shape, the red triangle do you have on the table? They pick it up with the right hand, but then the left hand, which is a different consciousness, take the triangle and put it back to the table, just to bother the other side of the brain. So there are not only two separate personalities, but they are opposite and they are fighting each other.
And then I understand there's these two, you talked about the kind of the primitive brain or in our evolutionary development, where there's one that's more geared towards survival and those quick decisions and can be a little bit that fight or flight or a little bit savage, really. And then there's this slower reflective brain. And so if they're not talking to each other, that's, you know, it's a lot of conflict arises.
But in this case, the patients of this syndrome do not have a split between the reflective versus the integrative brains. So both sides of the brain have integrative and reflective parts. So the consciousness appears in both of them separately. It's not that you have one part of the brain saying you have to survive and the other you have to think slower. Both sides, both consciousness, have both parts of the brain, so to say.
And I'm wondering what your reflections are on those mentors, those teachers in your life, as you think about the future of education and just those teachers along the way that helped you find your path.
There were several. I think of them, you know, quite frequently. The three of them just led my way to who I am today, what type of researcher I am today. So I was a good student when I was at high school, but I was very good at maths and science, etc. But I had not decided what I wanted to do, what I wanted to study. And then I had two teachers of biology. One was called Miguel del Pino. He was here in Spain because he appeared on the radio. And he was great at teaching us the beauty of nature and biodiversity and explaining how we are connected to nature and to other animals, for instance. And it's very sad because he recently passed away last week. And then the other one was called Manolo Ruiz. And he taught in a very completely different way. He was more a hardcore teacher in which you have to learn this, you know, strongly and through effort. But he showed us, for instance, the beauty of the Krebs cycle or the chemistry behind the photosynthesis. It was very inspiring to see that every molecule is positioned in the right place for the right enzymatic reaction. And in the end, you cannot understand why, but you have 30,000 genes and in community, they are generating individuals that are working perfectly well. It was surprising. So through these two teachers, I decided to study biology and evolution. There was not a program to study evolution or in an official way in Madrid, but there is a strong community of researchers working in neuroscience. I think mostly because we were strongly influenced by Santiago Ramón y Cajal, who was Spanish Nobel Prize in 1906, and he was, let's say, the father of neurosciences. So I studied brain anatomy, neuroanatomy, and neurodevelopment when I was there in Madrid. And then Carmen Rua was another teacher that really formed the way in which I think now, because she was showing us neuroanatomy of all the many different species, and it was surprising to see, just watching one single image of a brain, she was capable of telling us what species, what part of the brain, what types of neurons. And I wanted to be like her, right? This is how I became interested not only in evolution and biology, but also in the brain. And regarding how we are teaching our kids now, I'm not a professor, so I teach very little here at the university. And I'm not an expert in teaching, but I think we are not doing it right. So for instance, I mentioned before that we have to write more with our hand. It just forces our brain to fix memories, and it is much more helpful than typing on a computer. But in the end, now, when we have everything that we can learn, you can type it and ask ChatGPT or any other AI systems, you can have it there in 30 seconds. So I don't think it makes sense for us to keep imposing ourselves to learn things by heart. We have to learn to think. We have to learn what is relevant and how to think relevantly instead of just memorizing, as I did, the 20 different enzymes which are involved in the Krebs cycle within our cells, right? So in a way, I think we have to remain working with books, paper, and pen. But at the same time, the way in which we expect college students to acquire new knowledge has to be through reflection more than through memory.
Yeah, that opens up a lot for people to the creative aspect, because now we can outsource our memories to our devices, but it also frees us up to be a little bit more creative because we're not devoting as much of our brain to that memorization act. And you mentioned that writing helped illuminate your understanding of the brain. And in terms of your reflections on the importance of the arts and humanities as a part of the education system, in some ways, we've kind of been turning our backs a little bit on that in favor of STEM, but they are so important, even to, for helping us understand the sciences as a metaphor, or, you know, imagining new ways forward.
They're truly important because, as I said, art is not just a painting that you like or not. It's the expression of an opinion of an artist through arts, so through an artwork. So you can enjoy Beethoven's symphony, but then when you understand that with this artwork, he was claiming, I am an artist and I am more important than my artwork, then that piece of work becomes even more relevant and you can enjoy it even further. And I think it is the same for science. We have to embrace arts in all our decisions and in the way we explain things in the lab or in our articles, for instance, because in the end, we are not just showing in our articles just a raw or a cold piece of data. We are expressing our own opinions, our own interpretations on what we think about that piece of data. So the computer can give us a graph, but the graph itself says nothing unless we, with our knowledge, with our previous history, with our readings, we make sense of this graph and we explain it to the reader in a way that can be understandable by all of them, right? So we have to understand how they did it in the arts to make it possible for us as well. We are using arts for many aspects of science. So from the experimental design, there are elegant experiments. Those are the best ones because they give very little room for interpretation. This is something relevant or not, for instance. But then we have to write a lot. So we are not writers. And scientific writing is completely different to literature, for instance. But we have to read literature to understand how to explain a concept. But also, right now, we are expressing in our talks or in our articles, we're expressing our concepts not only through writing, also visually, through figures and photographs. We have to accept that we are expressing an opinion from the very moment that we take an image in the microscope. You selected it, and you selected it for expressing the concept that you want to express, right? So it's not that you go and randomly you come up to this neuron and you present it, that the reader has to make up an opinion on what the neuron means. No, it's you selecting what part of the brain you take the image, in what context, how do you illuminate the neuron, and how you draw the scheme at the end of the article to explain your concept. This is fully at work.
Oh, it's so true, because there is the science and then there's communicating the science so that we, the public, can move forward and understand it and add our voices or perspectives and implement it. Thank you, Dr. Fernando Garcia Moreno, for a most illuminating discussion, for sharing your research and work exploring the deep evolutionary roots of the brain and what they reveal to us about human identity, culture, complexity, and the future of technology in our lives. Thank you for adding your voice to the creative process.
Thank you so much, Mia, for your invitation. I enjoyed a lot of this insightful conversation.
Creative Process Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interviews producers on this episode were Sophie Garnier and Virginia Machetti. The Creative Process is produced by Mia Funk. Additional production support by Katie Foster. Wintertime was composed by Nicholas Anadolis and performed by the Athenian Trio. We hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community, exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just follow us on Instagram on @creativeprocesspodcast and send us a DM. Thanks for listening.